Represent is brought to you by the Platinum Card from American Express. There's a world of experiences waiting to open up with the Platinum Card, backed by the services and security of American Express.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Well, well, well. I didn't think you were coming.
I told you we were coming.
I'm just playing. And look at this little man. We'll be fraught. How are you doing, big man?
Hungry?
You come to the right place. Cousin Julie been fixing food all day.
This is my friend Isaac.
Gilroy. All my friends call me Gilly. Any friend of Cleopatra is a friend of mine.
I didn't know there'd be accents.
Excuse me?
Hey everyone, welcome back to Represent. And as you probably can tell, I am not Aisha Harris, your host, but Verilyn Williams, your producer. Aisha is doing her thing on a last-minute reporting trip, so I am here to present today's segments. In a bit, we're going to bring you a conversation Aisha had with Janixa Bravo, the up-and-coming filmmaker known for her off-kilter storytelling in her debut feature, Lemon, which opens up in limited release this weekend. But first, after joining us last week to discuss the indie doc Whose Streets, Jamel Bowie returns. This time, he and Aisha discuss a film depicting injustice to Black Americans in a very different way. Catherine Bigelow's much-criticized Detroit. Check it out.
Well, I am right now reporting out of state for another piece I'm working on at Slate, which is why I sound a little funny. I am on the phone. Verilyn is back in Brooklyn. She is recording this. And we also have Jamel, who is down in D.C. Welcome back to the show, Jamel.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this makes 2 weeks in a row now, because last week we talked about Whose Streets. And this week we are going to be talking about a subject matter that is just as depressing, I think, but is set a little bit further in the past. It is the movie Detroit, which was directed by Catherine Bigelow and was written the screenplay with her frequent collaborator, Mark Bull. And, I mean, a lot has been said about it already, and I've even said some stuff. I was on Pop Culture Happy Hour a couple weeks ago talking about it. But I do think that there is still a conversation to be had about this, especially, I mean, just in light of everything that's happening in Charlottesville right now, and just everything that seems to be happening throughout this entire presidency. And this movie was timed to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the Detroit riots. And just as a quick, in case people haven't been paying attention or they're not aware, the Detroit movie starts with the Detroit riots, and it kind of focuses, for the most part, about 40 minutes to maybe an hour, it felt like a very long time, on the Algiers Motel incident, which is a very heavily disputed incident that occurred in the midst of the Detroit riots, where three young black male teenagers, were killed in this annexed building of the Algiers Motel. There were lots of different law enforcement there of all sorts, Detroit PD, there was also National Guard was there, some state troopers were there, and everyone has a different account of what happened. Several other people who survived the night, black men, and two white women who were in the building were tortured, allegedly, for hours. And so Catherine Bigelow and Mark Bull focus on that incident specifically. And a lot of people have had a lot of thoughts about this movie and whether or not they should have been able to tell this story, whether or not they told this story correctly. There was one piece in the Huffington Post recently that was written by three academic professors, Jean Theo Harris, Say Bergen, and Mary Phillips, where at the end of their piece, after making their case for why this movie is so wrong, they say, quote, if you want to see something that takes seriously the issue of police brutality against black people or the actual history of Detroit, don't see this movie. So, Jamel, you've seen the movie. Obviously, I've seen the movie. Would you recommend this movie to people you care about?
Absolutely not. I got to be honest for the sake of full disclosure. I got through about 105 minutes of the movie, and then I left the theater.
I had the same impulse as you did, although I did not leave the theater. At what point did you wind up leaving?
I ended up leaving at the point where the last victim was killed unceremoniously on screen. And specifically, I'll tell you the exact moment when I got up. It was the sadistic police officer shot him twice off screen, And then it cuts back to that room, and you hear him put two more bullets into the body. And at that point, which by this point in the movie, I had basically watched several of these unceremonious deaths of characters who weren't really even characters, who seemed to just exist solely for the purpose of being tortured and killed. I was just like, I don't need to see any more of this. Like, This is gratuitous and pornographic, so I'm done.
Yeah. I have the same exact reaction as you did, and I think a lot of people did. And what's interesting is that I came away from the movie feeling as though this was a movie that was supposed to be, it was written, it's obviously conceived by white people. And I know that Catherine Bigelow has stated she's had input from other, obviously Mark Bull spoke to some of the survivors of the incident, including Melvin Dismukes, who was the, I guess he was sort of a guard who happened to, he was a black guard who was played by John Boyega in the movie, who happened to be there that night. And it's disputed what happened, how he took part in all of that. He also spoke with Larry Reed, who was played by Algie Smith in the movie. And he's the kind of the lead singer of a wannabe Motown group. And they have that sort of input. And also she's also name checked Henry Louis Gates and Michael Eric Dyson. But I came away from the movie thinking this was meant for white people, not like, and white people who, her intent, she said, was to sort of start a conversation, because that's what we're always doing, is starting a conversation, about police brutality. And it seems like she wanted to evoke empathy from the viewer. Now, there are lots of black people, I think, who don't need to see this movie because we've seen this happen either in our own personal experiences or just having to watch the deaths of famous, I say famous in a cynical way, famous black men dying on screen and on video. And so I felt like the act of putting people in their shoes just felt so not for... I would not recommend it for anyone, but I would especially not recommend it for anyone who is a person of color. And that was my takeaway.
So I've heard, you know, quite a few people say that this is a movie primarily for white people and give that exact same explanation. But I got to confess, I don't really understand that point, because it's not just on a structural level of the film. It's not as if any of the people we encounter suffering anything. It's not as if we see them as people with interior lives and interiority, right? Larry, for example, gets basically a couple lines of dialogue letting us know that he's a singer. He's a good singer. He really wants to be famous. He has a girlfriend, and he's desperately trying to get laid, right? So we get like some really basic characterization, and then he's tortured for 45 minutes. And the same goes for the other characters. Anthony Mackie's character doesn't even really get that. He's just kind of like unceremoniously beaten half to death. And so if the goal is to put white audiences in the shoes of these characters, it doesn't really do that at all. And if the idea is to sort of make white audiences recoil at horror at what the white police officers are doing, it accomplishes that, but it also very much distances those white audiences from those police officers. I struggle to imagine the person of goodwill who could imagine themselves in the shoes of any of the officers or any of the National Guardsmen who turn a blind eye in that movie. It's, you know, if you were looking to create empathy and try to get white audiences or white people to understand and to empathize, it was a failure. I mean, I'm in my mind, I'm comparing it to basically the whole of Do the Right Thing, which does that successfully. And it does that by basically being a movie about black life that's interrupted by police violence. Gets the audience to sort of really dive into the humanity of these people. And so when everything unravels, you feel it viscerally. But that doesn't happen here. I did not like this movie. One thing that has stuck with me since last night is in the one of the opening sequences where we meet the police officers, who I should say, the central police officer's name, I don't remember who and whose actor, the actor who plays him, I don't recall.
Will Poulter, and the character's name is Krause.
So Krause is actually the only character who seems to have any kind of, like, inner life, which is interesting, or any kind of character arc. But in the first scene involving him, you see him basically run down and mortally wound a black person who had been, you know, stealing groceries from a grocery store. And that black character is mortally wounded. We don't know his name or anything. He runs away. He crawls under a car. An old woman comes to see what's wrong. And we watch basically him die, and then it cuts. And that's it. We don't know anything more about that person. That person existed solely for us to watch him get killed. And that treatment of black characters in the movie is, like, routine. And I find it very, very disturbing. And this is, you know, there are other things I find disturbing about it, too. Like how if the black people in the movie, if they're not being, like, unceremoniously, like, tortured and murdered, they're just part of an undifferentiated mass of, like, anger. Which is, like, weird for a movie that's supposed to be, you know, nominally committed to black people as people. So, sorry, I can go on like this for a long time because I found this, like, a travesty of a movie.
Yeah, I mean, to your point about this being for white people, I actually agree with your rebuttal. I do think that, for me, it is, that is what Catherine Bigelow, that was their intention. And they clearly don't succeed in that. And other people have made this point. But I think that the weird part about it is that the characters are also passive. There is no activism being shown. They put on this weird, like, not a coda, but like weird prologue at the beginning that seems sort of tacked on, where it's, they have, you know, this Jacob Lawrence-like artwork happening while they're quickly attempting to explain how the protests were, you know, born out of years and decades of frustrations with inequalities and inequities of Detroit and the black people of Detroit. And that's, like, the closest I think they come to admitting that there was a reason behind the reason why the protests really started. It wasn't just someone decided to throw something through a window, and then that's how everyone just got riled up. You walked out of the end of it, Janelle, but actually, well, you didn't walk out of the end. You walked out because there's still like a good 30 to 40 minutes left of the movie after the last person in the film dies, because who knows why. And so the Algie Smith character, the lead singer, Larry Reed, he gets a little bit more of an arc. Like, you see him, he's unable to, he can't rejoin the band afterwards. He's so shaken up by it. And this is all pretty much based in reality of what happened to the real Larry Reed, in that he decided not to join the group, or decided to leave the group, and then went on to sing in a gospel choir. And then they fly really quickly through, like, this courtroom drama that, like, basically compacts, like, years of courtroom drama that occurred in real life into, like, one sort of courtroom saga. It's just a movie that also obviously clearly doesn't have a focus. It has a focus for 40 minutes, which is that torture. But then at the beginning, it's all about the riots. And at the end, it's about, like, the courtroom. It's just kind of all over the place. And I think that's a lot of where it fails. Now, I want to talk a bit about the Melvin Dismeek's character, John Boyega's character, because I feel like he is sort of the poster child for the many things that this movie gets wrong, which is based on, and again, all of these accounts have been disputed, and a lot of it is fuzzy. People have different memories. People have lied. Really, this movie was put together based on as much, you know, research, but also creative license as possible. But the thing that struck me, and I wrote about this in my piece for Slate, in which I discussed what was sort of fact and fiction between real life and the movie, is that Melvin Dismeek in real life was accused by at least two of the victims who survived the night of participating in the beatings that occurred. And in this movie, Melvin Dismukes, John Boyega's character, is just as, he's pretty passive in that he can't really do anything. He's in the hotel while everything is happening, and like many of the other people there, he doesn't do anything, although he does at one point attempt to take one of the men upstairs to help them find the gun that these cops are like saying they want to find. And he says, like, I want to help get you through the night. But it just rubs me the wrong way, the fact that, and maybe it would have been disastrous to have Kathryn Bigelow and Mark Boal attempt to make this character a little bit more fleshed out and to question his involvement. But the fact that he doesn't do anything and is like painted as sort of this helpless character when in real life he was accused of participating, like, I feel like that was missing a whole other layer of complexity and complicity that could have been further explored.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it sort of, as you said, illustrates one of the central problems with this movie, which is that I don't think it had a vision of Black personhood. So it's not just that our victims have no interiority, but that John Boyega's character, who is supposed to be, in the film's portrayal, some sort of hero, doesn't really have it either. We don't really know why. We don't really know. We don't know anything about his motivation. We don't know anything about why he's doing what he's doing. We get no sense of how he feels to be basically law enforcement at this period. I mean, there's nothing there. He's just kind of he's a chess piece. He's there to make certain things in the plot happen. And when he's not needed for the plot, he is sort of moved aside. I mean, it's really striking to me that Bigelow and her team have made this movie that has a lot of Black characters, but like no actual Black people, if that makes any sense.
Yes. Yes. It makes a lot of sense. There's a lot more we could say. One thing I do want to sort of wrap this up with is the question that we've been asking ourselves a lot this summer. It's been framed as like, who's allowed to tell these stories? And I think there have been good arguments made about it. Dana Stevens, our colleague, has written a really smart piece about for Slate about this very question. But I think of it more as like, when these stories are told, how are they supposed to be told by the people who might not be a part of those communities or a part of those demographics? We had an episode earlier this summer where we discussed Sofia Coppola in The Beguiled and her Civil War set thriller, which featured not a single Black person in sight, and explains it away at the beginning of the movie as saying that all the slaves have run away. And she came under fire for that by saying, you know, I felt like I couldn't tell the story, that like I would wade into some tricky waters there and I didn't want to do it. And, you know, some people have argued, well, maybe that's for the best. I think, you know, you can't make a Civil War movie and not have a Black person on screen. It just doesn't make sense. And I also think that's just a cop-out. I want white directors to wrestle with these things, even if it does come out like Detroit. That being said, sitting through Detroit was one of the most torturous things. I've said it before, like 12 Years a Slave looks like a walk in the park compared to this movie, just because the torture is unrelenting. It's basically like watching Patsy get whipped for 45 minutes straight, as opposed to just 2 minutes out of a 120-minute movie. So I guess my question I would pose to you is, aside from it not being Kathryn Bigelow or Mark Boal telling the story, what would have been a better choice in your mind of how to make this movie?
That's an interesting question. So one of my sort of like problems with the movie on the technical level is that there's never a sense, even before we get to the Algiers Motel, this movie has like a teleology, if that makes any sense. That like the scene when they're in the theater and about to perform before the Motown executives, even that scene, which I think is supposed to be lighthearted, is shot and lighted and scored in such a way as to imply the Algiers Motel sequence. If part of the experience of police violence and police brutality is the randomness of it all, and the arbitrariness of it all, I would actually try to translate that to film, and try to communicate to viewers that these are ordinary people caught up in an arbitrary and brutal system, which I think is possible to do. Like, again, Do the Right Thing, I feel like it's a model for this.
Yeah, I agree with Do the Right Thing. The problem is that that movie, in my eyes, is so perfect that anyone who's tried to copy it has always failed. I think personally what I would have done was something similar, in that I would have made the first part much more about their lives. I think, though, I wouldn't even really have, I mean, flashback is so overdone, but I feel like this could have been much more powerful had it been, we see what they were like before, and then the bulk of the movie is about what the people who lived through that night had to deal with afterwards. And, you know, we can learn about the incident from the various perspectives through flashback, but then we see more of Larry Reed having to struggle and deal with, like, the PTSD that came from that experience. We see Anthony Mackie's character. We see the way in which Melvin Dismukes was labeled. I mean, even before this, I think he said he had been called an Uncle Tom just because he, you know, was a guard, and he wasn't quite law enforcement, but he was, you know, in a position of authority in a way that a lot of the black people around him were not. And, you know, I'm just tired of seeing the suffering. And I think even in our own media coverage, so often we see the suffering, but then, like, we don't often go back and revisit the people who are left, who are still dealing with these issues. Every once in a while, you might get a profile, you know, about, you know, Michael Brown's mother or something, but, like, what about the people who are, like, also affected after the fact? Like, how that lingers. And to me, that would have been much more powerful, a statement about the way in which police brutality and racism, more generally, systematically, really infects and poisons people's lives. So I feel like just less, so much less of that torture, and so much more of the lingering effects would have been much more effective. And I think that says a lot about what they chose to focus on as the subject matter, which was not that.
I agree with that.
Well, I think both Jamel and I are not necessarily recommending this movie. It's playing in theaters now. If you do want to watch it, I would say maybe wait until it's streaming and you can kind of pause it and not have to sit through it interminably. But yeah, just those are our thoughts on Detroit. Thank you so much, Jamel, for joining us again. And hopefully next time we can talk about something a little happier.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Represent is brought to you by the Platinum Card from American Express. Say there's a film festival in Mexico that holds outdoor screenings, or there's this shop in Chicago that's been selling house music since before it was house music, or there's this comic book store in LA where comedians try out new material in the back room. There's a great big world out there, and no other card lets you discover it like the Platinum Card, backed by the service and security of American Express.
Up next, Aisha's interview with Janixa Bravo about her new movie, Lemon. The indie dramedy stars Brett Gilman, her frequent collaborator and partner, as well as Michael Cera, Judy Greer, and one of my all-time favorites, Nia Long. The film is a bit difficult to describe. As a movie, it's bizarre in many ways and also unsettling, but essentially it's about a man who descends into despair and emotional instability when his live-in girlfriend decides to end the relationship. This conversation with Janixa had her discussing everything from her intent behind the film, her defiance of expectations people have of her as a black female filmmaker, and directing that great episode of Atlanta, Juneteenth.
Well, it is a pleasure to have Janixa Bravo on today to talk to me about your movie, Lemon.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome. So we were just chatting. Listeners didn't hear it, but like we were just talking about how we actually met once before at South by Southwest earlier this year. And I caught the movie first there. And I saw you afterwards and we chatted a little bit. And I don't know if I told you this then, but I can say with confidence now that I have seen the movie twice and I still am like, what just happened?
Oh, that's great. Like, I think that's the best takeaway.
Yeah, I still it's one of the weirdest, and I don't mean this in like a negative pejorative way. Like, it's one of the weirdest movies I've seen in a very long time. And I can't wrap my head around it. And as an artist, like, I don't expect like people, directors and filmmakers to like explain everything. But what I'd like to
know. But you'd like a little bit of explanation.
Well, yeah. Well, I would love to get a little bit of like, where did the story and these characters originate for you in like your mind?
I'm happy to discuss. I think, and to sort of answer the word weird, I don't mind the word weird out of the right person, right?
Yeah.
Like, sometimes people say weird and they mean it as in a diminutive fashion. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, I use that word all the time, but to me it's like imbued with positivity and mm-hmm. like weird feels like exciting and yeah. curious and is something that makes me inquisitive. And as you can imagine, our film has been referred to as weird a lot. And there's multiple camps of weird,
right.
of like the some writers, when they write about it as weird, I'm like, I know where it's coming from because it's next to like sexy words.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's weird that is next to words that are like bummers. So there's that. But where it came from, I wrote the movie with my partner, Brett Gelman, mm-hmm. and we wrote the film.
And he also stars in the film.
And he also stars in the film, yes. We wrote the movie 5.5 years ago, the first draft of it, and it was written at South by Southwest, actually. I had met these women who work at Sundance. They work in the writing lab. I met them at a party on a dance floor. They'd seen my first short film, which is called Eat,
mm-hmm.
which Brett is in, and also this actress, Kevin Waterston.
Yeah.
And they really liked it and were sort of curious if I had another film or a feature that I was working on, and I lied and said yes because if I've learned anything from LA is that you can make up your own narrative and people are like, that's great.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, lie. Also, my best friend who is a filmmaker was like, just say yes to everything. Like, don't tell them how you feel. Don't tell them you're like not okay. Don't like just say yes and like pretend like everything's fine. I was mm-hmm. like, got it. Okay.
It's like improv.
Yeah. I went to theater school. I know how to pretend. So they asked if I had a feature. I said that I did. And I didn't realize that these women had worked at Sundance in that moment. And had I would not have said so because I would have assumed they were asking me for something. And mm-hmm. so I lied. And then at the end of the night, they handed me a business card, one of them, and said, hey, we're still considering scripts for our summer lab. I'd love to read that movie. And I was like, oh, yeah. What's the timeline on this? Like, when do you need that by?
Yeah.
And she's like, you know, as soon as tomorrow. And I was like, but like, if I had more days, what would the most amount of days I could have? And I was like, because I haven't revisited it in a while. So like, what's the most amount of days?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know, five days. How about 5 days? And I was like, great. And whatever day of the week it was like near the weekend. So
okay.
I was like, oh, that's perfect. Gives me enough time to reread and make notes and changes before I send it over. So cut to the party's over. I'm walking home and I've got this like card from these ladies at Sundance. I'm like, oh my God, I've wanted this for so long. And like, here I am. It feels like I'm arriving at this thing and I don't even have all the tools to get there. And so to Brett, I told him about the women that I met and he's like, he remembered them. He talked to them. And I was like, I lied to them. He's like, okay, about the script that we don't have. And he was like, we? I was like, yeah, we's underlined because I did say that we were working on it together. And
what?
He's like, oh my God, like that's so fucked up. Can I say that? Can I say bad words?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Can I say bad words?
Oh, all the time. All the time.
And so we ended up writing it together. And we wrote it in 5 days. We sent the draft along and it was terrible. So as any first draft is, a little bit wonky, but this was like trash. And but the genesis for it or the sort of like there are many, many seeds, but the biggest, I would say the two things that kind of came together were I'd gone to theater school to be a director, and at this point I was 30 and I wasn't directing. I was working as a stylist and I found myself really frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'm going to wake up somewhere down the line and not really know how I got here in my life. And that not everybody gets to do the thing that they want to do, right? Like, not everybody gets to arrive at or realize their dreams. And maybe I'm one of those people and I don't know it. And is that what my sort of is that my line that I'm going to walk? And for both Brett and I, we'd had this kind of feeling of frustration of, oh, everyone in our life is passing us by and we're getting left behind. And
that feeling,
juicy, sexy feeling.
We've all been there. Yeah.
And at that time, because I was 30 and he was 35, there was also the it seemed like people were starting to have kids. They were starting to get married. He had friends who were like buying houses, and we were like, "What?"
I have friends buying houses.
Yeah,
it's
just like,
weird.
I'm supposed to buy a house? Like, I haven't even like I'm like behind on so many things. Like, and it was just really stressful. It's like we were entering these. There are these massive markers you're supposed to check off, and we were not anywhere near checking them off. And it was just like, oh my goodness, we're impotent and we don't know it. So that was kind of the biggest seed, this fear of it. And I think for both of us, I really felt, and I think Brett felt this way too, that if we wrote it all down, we were going to kind of like exorcise it, sort of like witch magic, right? You write it all down, you light it on fire, and then it won't happen. I think that's what we kind of felt in that moment. And so there was that. And then the other thing was, I wanted to be working in comedy, and I did not feel there was a space for me. You know, comedy seems to exist in two camps. I'm going to apologize now. All of my answers are 35 years long.
Yeah.
there seems to be two camps of comedy. There's black comedy, I guess, and then there's white comedy, I guess.
How would you define
And that's purely that black comedy has black people in it, right? And then, like, white comedy, it seems to be everything else. And I don't think anyone's calling it that. Mm-hmm. But that's what I felt I had noticed. And the work that I was writing, which was a little bit unusual, even for by white standards, I guess, and it didn't seem to have a home. I just felt like there wasn't a home for me in what seemed to be the two camps of like what I was noticing in humor. And so I found that when I was watching work made by my peers, there also seemed to be this this common theme, or there seemed to be this like new genre almost of comedy of like this like white dude in his mid to late 30s who was bad at everything.
The Apatow and the mumblecore.
Yeah. And sometimes they were sort of interchangeable, and it's not meant to be an assault, you know, Lemon is not an assault on that space, but it is having a conversation with this form, this kind of white male who is floundering. And there's just something about those guys in those movies that everything works out for, right? And everyone's just like, I don't know, there's just something about him. And you're like, really? Because I'm watching him and he should go. I think he should go. He's got to go.
I am so glad you're saying this. Because now this is all kind of clicking together.
You're like, oh, so that's what Lemon is.
All right.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
Now you see.
I do. I totally see it. And
it's essentially White Guy Fail is the other title for Lemon.
It is. So Isaac essentially, or Brett's character, Isaac, like, I kept watching him and really watching everyone in this movie for the most part, except for Nia Long's character. And I want to get back to Nia Long because I love Nia Long. But, like, we'll talk about that shortly. But everyone in this movie, or at least the men, were all kind of, like, terrible.
The worst.
There was no redeeming quality. And that, like, I thought, like, I was just like, why is this man doing all of these terrible things? Specifically, there's this bubbling violence underneath that I don't think we usually see in these movies. Of like, I mean, some I guess maybe Anchorman is like a sort of a more like crazy version of that. There's a lot of violence in that movie and rage, but with this movie, like, the violence is very intense and very scary. There's a moment where Isaac tells his estranged, I guess, girlfriend, or like, she doesn't want to be with him anymore, but he keeps clinging to her, who's played by Judy Greer, who's amazing, and he's like, you know, I could kill you right now, or he says something like that.
Do you know how many men have killed their girlfriends and wives? Millions. I could have done better than you. I settled because I didn't think that anyone else would want me. I thought I chose you because I felt sorry for you, but really, I felt sorry for myself. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I don't want you to leave me. Please don't.
I deserve to be with a man who wants me.
And then it just you just let it be.
Yeah.
And I'm just talk a little bit more about
it. Talk about violence.
Well, I just get like this white male this undercurrent of white male anger and violence.
Well, again, to sort of speak to that genre, I can't remember what it was that I had seen when we were sort of piecing together the idea. And perhaps my not remembering is also that these people are people I know who will be like, thanks, Janixa. But there seemed to be a kind of interchangeable quality, right? And when I was looking at that form of the floundering, fumbling white male, the three places that he seemed to exist in was in the eyes of his family, his relationship to love, and his relationship to career. And so the film is divided into these three. The first third of the movie is career with a little bit of love. Mm-hmm. And then the second part of the film is all family. And it's also to see a little bit of like where your trauma comes from. And then the third is back to full love. It's sort mm-hmm. of the full evolution of that space. And the idea is, I feel in those movies, is these guys kind of fail at all of them, but somehow everything works out. And I thought, well, what if you just failed at all three? Because that is the reality of the kind of person you've presented me with.
Right.
And that's also like how you're presenting a picture of white mediocrity and white privilege that prevails. Mm-hmm. But the whole premise of that space is that it wouldn't, right?
Right.
Like, and so I was like, but I can't see it that way. That's not how I see it. And I would never, I think it'd be hard to write women and people of color as characters like these that the takeaway was like, I don't know, there's just something about him. I don't think you'd get that.
No.
I mean, I remember, and this film is not exactly that, but I can't recall the name of the movie, but there was a movie with Charlize Theron where she was, I think, sort of an unlikable type.
I just watched it. It was a young adult.
Yeah, and I think people had a hard time with that film because there was something sort of like ugly about her.
I really liked that film.
I did too. I thought it was great. It was having a conversation that I thought was really interesting. Yeah. And you don't get to see women or people of color in these spaces and where the audience will accept them at the end. And so I think both Brett and I found that work to be like kind of hostile. I mean, I found it to be an assault on me mm-hmm. and how I process and how I lived in the world. And I was like, anthropologically, that's not my narrative.
Right.
And so that's my sort of offering to that space. Were I to make a film in this genre, this is how I see that world unfolding. And I think there is a kind of unspoken rage and violence and ineptitude that is – the volume isn't all the way turned up on. So they end up being like the – I don't know, there's something about him, right? And I was like, I don't know, there is something about him. He's not well. He should be locked up.
I mean, that was the thing with Isaac's character. And then we also have in Eat, Brett Gelman's character again, who I don't remember if he's named or not. But
August is his name.
August.
Yeah.
Okay. And for listeners, Eat, the basic premise is that Catherine Waterston's character is locked out of her apartment and her neighbor, who's played by Brett Gelman, he sort of helps her, or he like lets her in to call someone to get her keys, and then it turns into this crazy it's
he
weird.
Strangles her.
He strangles her. Spoiler alert, he strangles her. And then also Michael Cera's character, because you've cast Michael Cera a couple of times now. He was also in the short film Benny Go Boom.
Gregory Go Boom.
Gregory Go Boom.
I like Benny Go
Benny
Boom.
Benny Go Boom.
Who's Benny? Where he is?
I don't know. And in that, he's also kind of a terrible person. He has a medical problem that confines him to a wheelchair. But it's hard to be sympathetic for him because he also says really mean things to women and is also kind of racist. And then at the end, like, spoiler alert, douses himself in gasoline and goes boom. And that was the thing that I found really fascinating is that there was like I could see each of these men turning into the men that we see committing these like mass shootings, these actual terrorist attacks that happen by white men in America. And like that undercurrent, like to me, now that you say that, it makes sense to me. Like, all these characters in these like Apatow movies and all these mumblecore, like they are actually unstable and they need to get their white maleness reined in and no one does.
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be a I don't know if it's like maybe sickness is too harsh, but I I liken it to, and I recall hearing this about, I have a dog. I have a small dog. And when I rescued my dog, I had been told by many people who'd had rescue dogs or fancy dogs, like the people when you have a dog, and I imagine when you have a child, it's very similar. There's like lots of like advice that is uninvited. Mm-hmm. And the main thing that I got, the through line main sort of takeaway was like, your dog needs to be socialized. And a socialized dog is a dog that like goes to dog parks and hangs out with other dogs and right. goes on hikes and hangs out with other dogs and like just knows is really good at hanging out with other dogs. Ultimately, my dog is kind of a cunt. I love her deeply. She's my favorite. She's the best. But she's just like an asshole. Aww. She likes people. She doesn't really like dogs.
My puppy is the same way. She likes people. We take her to the dog park. Dog. She doesn't do anything.
No, she'd go to the dog park and she'd stand next to me and stare at me like, when are we leaving? This is not great.
This is just like my dog.
And you know, truth be told is I like her preferred dog parks to people parks. So I like fully understand. And so the thing, this idea of being socialized, like being good at being like a full person, full dog, whatever that is, I think these men are not socialized. I think they weren't born with it actually. Mm-hmm. That thing that he just has, he doesn't actually have it. It's the maker, the viewer, the writer has imbued him with something that he actually doesn't have. Mm-hmm. Because I am watching and going, but I don't understand. He would never be allowed anywhere in my life at all. Next to me, nowhere. Can't. But somehow, and it's because they're seeing themselves in it, right? Like you see yourself in the work, and then you want to take care of yourself, and you want to create a narrative where you get to be accepted. We're getting really deep here.
Well, that's what we like to do. And I also wanted to figure out what the fuck was going on with this movie. So I'm glad we are. So you mentioned that like these characters, these types of characters that are usually written, like they would never be in your life. Like, that's not realistic.
I mean, they are.
They are, but you wouldn't want that. Like, you wouldn't react to them in the way that people in those other movies do react to him.
Yeah.
Nia Long's character, she, you know, he pursues her in the most awkward of and kind of creepy of ways. And we even get a scene of him, like, imagine like masturbating to the idea of her. What can you talk about her character and how she sort of fits into this world? Because she does, for even though he says very awkward things about black people and it's just really like you can tell he's off, like she still like invites him to her family's barbecue and invites him to have dinner with her son. And why?
Good question. There's two parts to that. And that was the hardest thing to write, or the hardest thing to arrive at and rationalize for myself and for Brett. We both were like, we know this has to happen because this is this conversation we want to have with this kind of character in this movie. You know, like in the girlfriend that stays there's the one that leaves and then there's the one that stays and you're like, why would she stay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel generally like not satisfied by like the answers there if there are answers in those films.
Yeah, there might not be.
Yeah, I guess there aren't. It's kind of like the onus is on you, right?
It's more about the feeling or like the emotion of like what that's trying to get at.
Totally. And yeah. So I think for us, like, it was when, and I should engage in the sort of how we talked to Nia about it too, because it was like a three-way conversation. In the writing of it, we knew that it just had to happen. And in the shooting of it and the presentation of it, I always said, I was like, this is the part of the movie the audience will be like, no. And I know it. They'll be like, no, there's just no way. That woman wouldn't do that. And I was like, and I totally get that and I understand that. And to sort of bring up, because you brought up Eat before, it's the same. That woman is similar to Catherine's character, mm-hmm. which is like she knows she shouldn't. She like walks in and she's like, I should go. But then she keeps staying. And there is this, what's her name? Is it Judy Smith? Is Judy Smith who Scandal is based on?
Yes.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, okay, yeah, the high-powered
fixer.
Yeah,
like, exactly, the, like, real-life fixer. And I remember around the time when we were writing her, maybe Brett had and I hadn't had listened to this, like, interview with Judy Smith, and she talked a lot about, like, the kinds of she'd worked with a lot of people who'd been abducted or raped. And most of the women, she said, who had been abducted or raped had said almost the same thing, which was that they would – the man or person or persons that did this to them, when they encountered them on the street, they felt their body told them like something was wrong, and that they told their brain that was crazy. Mm. They talked themselves out of it. And so I was really fascinated by that, like that little thing, because I know that I have that, like for sure. I definitely am like in situations with like men where I'm like, I don't know how I got here. And I'm like talking to myself about I'm still in it. Like there's this one part of your brain that is like this, everything about this is wrong, which is in that first date that they have at the Chinese restaurant. She's like, I should leave. And she says it a few times where she's like, gotta go, can't be here, don't want to be here. Yeah. And then he asks to see her again, and she's like, oh, can't do that. Oh, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, fuck, I'm here.
First of all, I love the fact that Nia Long had like a nice sort of juicy part. I feel like she's very underused.
I a million percent agree.
She said,
I've never been in a movie like this.
No, that was the other thing is that like,
and that's our camp of, by the way, white comedy, black comedy.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
To go back to that, like Nia and I, when we met, which is almost about a year ago that we sat down to talk about Lemon, we were discussing these sort of like, there are also multiple camps of comedy, obviously.
Right.
But in thinking in umbrella terms that like black comedy primarily has black actors in it, and then white comedy does not have black actors in it.
Right.
And she had said to me just blatantly, she's like, I've never been asked to do a white comedy. And I started laughing because I was like, oh, do I work in white comedy? And she was like, yes, I've seen all of your movies. And I was like, okay, cool. And then she went on to elaborate on the like, no, it's like expressive. And it's unusual, and it's like it's absurd and a little experimental, and like I don't get invited to do stuff that's left of center, really.
And that's the thing, is left of center is so often associated with like the mumblecore crowd, which is very white. The Duplass brothers, Apatow on the higher level or the more mainstream level, even like Wes Anderson, like the quirky. And can you talk a bit about what that is like for you as a black female filmmaker who is making quote-unquote left-of-center movies? Like, what, like, do you, I'm sure you felt sort of pressure or expectations to make movies that are star just black people or mostly black people and that fit that white comedy, black comedy realm. And then, like, how is that received, like, in reviews? Like, because I think that if people went into this movie not knowing who you are, I would assume myself that
it was a white dude.
Yeah, it was a white dude. Or maybe
which
a white
woman.
I
think woman. Is
cool. Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm not, it's cool that you think I'm a white dude. You think I'm a white dude? Oh, it's all working. Yes, my plan. No, I think that that's cool that, meaning like in my direction, I guess, I've always kind of like wanted to sort of like not be engendered or not be like raced, and meaning like that it is very much me. And I think that the film feels like once you know that I am the person who made it, I think a lot of things do click in where you're mm-hmm. like, that's why there's all this weird race stuff. Like what feels like strange, uncomfortable race stuff
right.
is like clearly it's like, oh, it's a black person made this.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, for and to go to that, like there's a scene that was super important to me in the movie. And if I had time if we could have reshot it, I would have like extended it a little bit longer. But there is Brett's sister in the film, Shiri Appleby, mm-hmm. has an adopted black son. And the woman that takes care of him or the woman that works for her is a Latina woman. And there is this conversation about race and sort of like blacks and Jews at the dinner table. And it ends with like, and Shiri, who is defending her son's blackness, that scene ends with her like sending, like shooing her maid away to like go get her something.
Yeah.
And that the complication of like those three pieces like was so important to me, where I was like I think the nuance of that, that's not a white person, just can't direct that.
Yeah.
You can't direct that. And maybe I'm wrong, but at least for me, I feel like that's where I see myself most is being of color, also being Jewish, also being Latin. I was like, this is like my scene where like all of my groups come together.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as the obligation of like who you're working with, I made my first short film 6 years ago, and that was Eat. And Brett is my partner, my romantic partner, and he was an actor that was easy for me. It was like, you're right there, so you'll be in it. Yeah. You're my boyfriend, now husband. And then Catherine Waterston, also friend from school. And we just talked about working together. And so I just cast both of them. And there was also this, of course, in the back of my head, I'm like, they both work a lot. And they're not like known names at this point. And I can get into like a nice film festival if like there's like names that you kind of know. Yeah. I mean, I like understood that that's how the business worked at that point.
Yeah.
And so I cast both of them. And I bring up this film again, too, because like it was at that first festival I got into South By. I shot it in like September, October of the year, like 5 months before the festival. I submitted it. It got in. And I went to South By with it. And it was at my first or second Q&A that this black woman asked why there were no black people in the movie. She was like, when you said that you directed Eat, I like had this kind of moment on my seat of like, oh, interesting. And then she's like, and I want to know, you know, why didn't you cast black actors? And then she said more. And it was about like, you know, don't you think it's your obligation? And I felt obviously very cornered and I got a little bit defensive, but I answered it and it has stayed with me ever since. Like, I think about it all the time. I mean, it kind of like shook me a little bit. And it was because I don't know if this is a product of theater school. It's not that I had not considered race. Obviously, I had considered race. But in that space, in theater school, I was casting the people that were next to me. And I mean, I went to NYU. My studio was predominantly white. Yep. My friends were predominantly white. Those were the people that I was working with. My set designer, costume designer, production designer. I mean, everybody was white, you know. And I had not really realized it. Honestly, when she asked me that, I started to kind of do this like self-examination of like, oh my God.
What you said about like the everyone around you was white, that's the same thing that a lot of, you know, executives say about like, oh, well, we cast like, you know, these are the people who are available to us. These are the people who are coming through our casting agencies, which in turn puts the onus on the casting agencies, which in turn puts the onus on, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's like a chain of reactions. But I think the difference is that it's like it's tough because as a black person, do you have an obligation? I mean, maybe, but at the same time, when you are just starting out, it'd be one thing
it's
if
really
this was
hard
like
when you're just starting out.
Right. It's one thing if it's like Spike Lee, not that Spike Lee has ever not done this, but like it's well, he did 25th Hour, which was mostly white people. But like it's not like it's someone who has stature and you are not there yet.
You're, no.
And so when you say
but
that,
I want it
it's
to be
honest.
Recognized. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
And but it's hard to say that. You know, it's hard to be like like real talk, like I'm casting white people so that white people can hire me. Like, I mean, but can I really say that? I said that to a black filmmaker recently and she took that really, she was really pissed off at me and I was like, oh shit. I could feel that she was disappointed in me and I was like, I'm just being honest, like I want to be doing this like for my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that when I talked about myself as a director, people took me less seriously. When I had work that existed and it featured relatively known or known white actors, people saw me differently. They just did. And that is like, if I'm being honest, that is the reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the work would have been, I wonder, like, would the work have still, would that film have gotten into South By? I don't know.
You did do an episode of Atlanta. You directed an episode of Atlanta.
For Juneteenth, which was yesterday. Maybe we don't want to date the show, but.
Well, yes. at the time of this recording, it was yesterday. That was actually probably one of my favorite episodes. And I'm not just saying that because you're here. I've been saying that forever.
Oh.
But that, to me, shows, like, I think Atlanta is a show that has shown people other than those of us who already knew that black people can do quote unquote weird stuff, that black people can do weird stuff. And that show is very, it has so many elements of what we usually associate with someone like Louis C.K. or, I don't know, other quirky white dudes. Really quickly, can you talk about, like, what was your favorite scene of that episode to direct?
Oh man, I think probably my favorite was anytime I got to work with Donald and Zazie, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
And I also really liked the actor whose name I think is Rick in the piece. The couple, Cassandra and Rick, were superb. Like, they really just got it clicked in, like, getting to play with them in this kind of, like, I'm in an interracial couple, so, like, the politics of interracial couples when, like, one of them is, like, the white in the couple is, like, obsessed with blackness. Like, I've met this man before many times in my life.
Me too.
And so I just was, yeah, those are really good. I mean, it's hard. I don't know. It's hard to pick one. I like the stuff that I guess I was able to play with in absurdism the most, because mm-hmm. I am natural. My work is absurd and super theatrical. Mm-hmm. And that when Donald and Hero gave me an opportunity to be a part of it, that they were like, lean in, like, go you, mm-hmm. like, get like bananas. And I was like, really? There is this line that Stephanie Robinson, who wrote the episode, that says, I feel like I'm in an episode of a Spike Lee directed Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
And I like really thought about the like what that meant and kind of was like, play in that space. So mm-hmm. like bring in a little bit of the like Kubrick wides, juicy, upsetting, is everybody dead? And then bring in some of like Spike's movement. So yeah, it was really special. I'm so glad that I got to do that.
Yeah. My final question for you is, when is the last time you were watching something on TV or in a movie and you felt as though you saw yourself on screen?
The last time. And it can be not like a literal seeing myself. Maybe it can be like emotional, or you want it to be literal.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Whatever you felt as though you connected with it in a way in which you felt represented.
I would say it was this Argentinian film. I think it's Argentinian. It's called Wild Tales. Have you seen it?
No.
It's great. It's essentially four short films, maybe five short films, and they're anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes. And without giving anything away, there's kind of like a trauma that connects the pieces, even though they're individual. They're very much individual stories. Mm-hmm. And I had been told by four or five different friends that like they saw the movie, like it came out 2 or 3 years ago, and they were mm-hmm. like, you need to see this movie, it's you, I saw it, it felt like you. And and generally people say that and then you watch something and you're like, oh, so I feel like trash. and that was a part of my hesitation, was that I was like, I like these people, these are my good friends, I can't watch this movie and then be like, wow, friendship over.
Yeah.
So and the last person to say it was actually a black girlfriend, and I was like, oh, I got blacks telling me, okay, I gotta see it. And so
seal of approval.
Yeah, seal of, I mean, white dudes, I was like, I don't know, are you right? And then, but they were. It was like, it was me through and through. Emotionally, the palette, the design, it just felt very, it felt like my feelings. And it was like a little bit funny and a little bit tragic. I mean, even just like the opening of the movie, this really horrible thing happens like within the first like eight minutes. And I was like, oh, this is for me. So I recommend it, Wild Tales.
Great. I'll have to check that out.
Cool.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was
I
so
hope
wonderful.
You liked my 30 hour answers, and I feel like you asked a lot of things that I didn't answer, but
no, I think
to future hangs.
Yes.
Yeah.
To future hangs.
Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's a wrap. Represent is produced by me, Verilyn Williams. Aisha Harris, as y'all know, is our esteemed host. Our wonderful social media assistant is Marissa Martinelli. And our intro-outro music is performed by the sweet San Francisco funk soul band, Midtown Social. Also, I want to give a huge thank you to everyone that showed love for our four-part series, Represent Rose, where I recap the last season of The Bachelorette with crunk feminist Robin Boylan. Don't worry, there are going to be many recaps in Represent's future. And final thing, if you're a parent or an involved auntie like I am, you should check out Slate's weekly podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting. On last week's show, a parent that was moving his family to Milwaukee called in to get advice choosing between a cheaper home or a better, aka whiter, school district. And y'all should listen to that conversation. I really appreciated the way that host Carvel Wallace unpacked what that question actually gets to. Listen and subscribe by searching Mom and Dad Are Fighting wherever you get your podcasts. All right, y'all. Until next time. Peace out.